Hello, everybody. I want to let you know, while you still have time to think better and come to this lecture, this is probably going to be the hardest lecture in the course because it's dealing with metaphysics and epistemology, and people tend to find those very tough subjects. But the good part is, if you can get through this lecture, then the rest of the course will be much easier for you, I think. This is the lecture that we're dealing with stuff that most people can find a bit difficult, but if we can just get through this, I think everything will be all right. Now, we want to ask, though, well, if metaphysics and epistemology are such a tough subject, why do we have to deal with them now? I guess somebody who's on the phone wants to know why we have to deal with metaphysics and epistemology. Well, the answer is that, remember, Rand holds that metaphysics and epistemology are really the fundamental basis of her thought. This is really, she has a system. In her system, there's a foundational level where we have metaphysics and epistemology, and the ethics and the political philosophy are founded on metaphysics and epistemology. So if somebody said, well, I'm just interested in Rand's defense of the free market or her particular views about minimal government versus anarchism, and somebody said, well, I like her system of ethics. I don't care about this metaphysics and epistemology stuff. Maybe that's for professional philosophers. She would not think that that would be a good way to go into her views. She thinks that the metaphysics and epistemology are basic to her system. And you remember that you can see this in Atlas Shrugged if you look at the way the parts of the novel or title she has these basic philosophical principles are right there at the heart of her system. We can't avoid talking about them. I don't think we should avoid anyway, not just because she holds this view, but I think even though they're difficult, they're a very interesting subject. Okay. Now, here we're going to go over in more detail some of the material I talked about last week. One is objectivism, that's the name of her philosophy, objectivism. It stresses the primacy of existence over consciousness. So existence refers basically to the physical world, say. You're looking out at the world and you see all these physical objects. That's existence. You're part of the physical world also, but your consciousness is just the act of looking out or thinking about what's out there in the world. So, she certainly doesn't deny consciousness. She actually very much thinks we are conscious. It would be kind of hard for somebody to say, I'm not conscious, although there are philosophers who tried it and done that, but she's certainly not one. She says, well, I know that I'm conscious, but consciousness isn't primary. What's primary is the world out there, and when I'm conscious, I'm thinking about something in the world. So consciousness is directed outward at the world. Say, there's the world out there, I'm conscious. You can imagine consciousness somewhat like as if it were an arrow pointing outward to the world. Now you might say, well, sure we can think about things in the world, but think about things that aren't in the world. I have to think of ideas that I have. Suppose I have an idea of the greatest conceivable being. That's a famous, getting famous argument by St. Anselm. Well, couldn't I just think about that idea, whether or not it exists in the physical world? Maybe there isn't the greatest conceivable being in the physical world, in the world that's out there, but couldn't I still think about it? And what Rand would respond there is, well, any idea that I think of that isn't in the physical world is derived from perception of the external world. So what's primary is this external physical world that I'm thinking about, that I can think about. My thought is directed outward at that, and even if I think of things that aren't in the world, those things I get by ultimately stem from perception of the external world. I can, as we'll be seeing a little later, how she thinks people do this. I can abstract from things what I see in the external world. I can come up with other ideas, but those ideas are derivative of what is there in the external world. Now, as I was just saying, all concepts, and concepts is just an idea that I have, are derived from the empirical world. Now, what is she rejecting when she says that? She says all concepts are derived from the empirical world. Well, some philosophers don't accept that. They say we have certain ideas that we don't get from the empirical world. We just have them. We're born with them, say. Some people think, for example, we don't get the idea of a substance from the physical world. We just have this innate concept of substances. And maybe we need something in the external world to trigger our becoming aware of this concept, but we don't get the concept by abstraction from the physical world. It's not derived from the physical world. So that is, she rejects that view. She said, no, there are no innate ideas. She said, the mind starts off just a blank slate. There is nothing, it doesn't start with any ideas, just gets all the ideas from the world around us. So you can think of something like this kind of physical way of picture. You can think of consciousness as if it's a beam of light. It doesn't have any content by itself. It just gets its content from what's out there and from what the mind can abstract from what's out there. Now, how do we get concepts from the empirical world? Remember, there are no innate ideas. We have to get them from the world out there. Well, what she says is that the senses, your hearing, sight, touch, taste, by using our senses, we can perceive similarities and differences among entities. Our senses enable us to see various things out there in the world. We can grasp similarities and differences. For example, suppose we see a lot of different objects, and all these objects are colored red. So when we're looking at these objects, say we're seeing a red apple, a red table, a red desk, not a member of the Communist Party, that would only come in later. Okay, so we're seeing all these red, that was supposed to be a joke, prolonged laughter. Okay, so we're seeing all these red objects. So she said, so these objects will be different in all sorts of different ways. After all, an apple is different from a book, and they'll be different shades of red. They won't be exactly the same shade of red. They'll differ in all sorts of different ways. So she said, well, the mind can grasp what all these entities have in common. In this case, it would be that they all have the color red. They're all red colored. So what the mind is doing, it's taking what the senses of seeing all these differences and grasp all these differences and similarities among the entities. And the mind can see, well, what do they all have in common? These objects are similar and different in various ways, but what do they have in common? It's the red color, and the mind can disregard all the differences and the similarities other than the red color. So Rand calls this measurement omission. Let's imagine, say, we're just considering the color. Say, you could imagine measuring the color red on a certain intensity scale. In various red objects would have different readings on this scale. So what the mind can do is say, well, this one measures this one measures that, this one measures that, but they're all red. We can disregard all these differences on that they have all the different measurements and say, what do they all have in common? So, she calls this measurement omission. Instead, if you want to see what her views on this, there is a book of her lectures called Introduction to Objectivist Epistemology, and it gives her account of the theory of concepts, and then they're in the edition edited by Leonard Peikoff, the conversation she had with various philosophers where they go into all sorts of points about this theory. But this is the basic idea. When I'm grasping, the senses are grasping all these similarities and differences, then the mind omits all these senses and similarities and differences. Says, well, what is it that these various entities have in common? And then you get an abstract idea or a concept. Now, once you've got a concept, then you're really ready to go, because you get a few concepts, and they're all derived in the same way by senses perceiving similarities and differences among entities. Of course, for different concepts, the senses would be perceiving different sets of similarities and differences. And in each case, the mind is grasping what the entities have in common through measurement omission. So, say we come up with various concepts, we have all these different concepts, then we can apply the same process, or it's a little bit different. Say we have concepts, then we don't need to bring in the senses again. We can take the concepts and then ask, what if the mind can then say, well, what do these different concepts have in common? So say we've got the concept red, say we've got the concept blue, the concept green. So in each of those, as I said a number of times already, we've gotten those concepts, these which we call first level concepts, the senses of perceived similarities and differences among various red entities, various blue entities, various green entities, and the mind has grasped what the entities have in common through measuring the machine, namely the color, red, green, or blue. So now we've got the concepts red, green, and blue, and now we can get another concept. Well, we say, what do these concepts red, green, and blue have in common? You've got the concept of color that can be filled in by these various colors. So they're all colors. So red, green, and blue are different, but we can abstract away from that and say, well, what do they have in common? They're all colors, so we can get a higher level concept, and that's how concept formation takes place, according to her. So that's really the basic part of her, that's really the basis of her epistemology. Epistemology means the theory of knowledge. So the basis of her epistemology is this is how we get concepts through abstraction from the senses by measurement omission. So we talk now about epistemology, how we know things. Now we want to turn to metaphysics, which deals with the nature of existence. What is the nature of existence? Now, the fundamental metaphysical principle, you'll see this is one of the titles of one of the parts of Atlas Shrugged. A is A. This is the fundamental metaphysical principle, maybe the fundamental medical principle, but even whether it is or not, it's the fundamental metaphysical principle. A is A, or everything is what it is. I think I quoted the last time Bishop Joseph Butler, who said everything is what it is and not another thing. So that's, according to Rand, the basic metaphysical principle. And she says, when you're considering, say, a thing is what it is, so when you're considering the properties of something, its causal properties are part of its identity. Say, one of the causal properties of a hammer is that it can knock nails into various substances like wood or various other things, depending on what kind of hammer and nail you have. So what the causal powers an object have are part of its identity. And in her account, suppose something causes something on one occasion. Like, let's say I'm hammering a nail into the wall so I can hang up a picture. So I hammer the nail in. Of course, I'll hit my thumb a few times to hammer it in. So if that happens, then according to her, under the same conditions, the hammer will always hammer the nail into the wall. It won't be that, say, I describe certain conditions like I'm hammering, the nail has all these physical properties, the wall has other properties, the hammer has all these properties. And I hammer it in using the same force. Everything is the same, but supposing it happened that one time the nail went in and one time it didn't, she would say, it can't happen that way. That would violate the law of identity if the nail went in one time and it didn't the other. Then there would have to be some difference in the conditions. Maybe I was hammering it less strongly the time it didn't go in, or I didn't hammer at the proper angle. So there'd be some difference. But in her view, if everything was exactly the same, then it couldn't be the case that it had an effect one time and didn't have that effect the other time. Now, another thing she thinks is involved in this law of identity, A is A, is that except for human choices, all properties and objects are necessary. Does everybody know what do we mean when we say something is necessary? That means it couldn't be otherwise. Supposing I say, if you boil water, if you heat up water, it'll boil at a certain temperature. Isn't it 212 or something like that? I forget what the temperature is. But if that's the right, if that's a property, of the water that will boil at a certain temperature. It couldn't have been otherwise. It couldn't have been that water boils, say, at 50 degrees. So objects have all the properties that they have necessarily. They couldn't have been otherwise. But there's an exception for this, namely human choices. So supposing you choose something, like you chose to attend my lecture. You probably think you made a big mistake, but you chose that. Your choice wasn't necessary. You could have chosen not to come to my lecture. You could have done something else instead. But you didn't. You came to this lecture. So you could have chosen otherwise, but other than that, she thinks all the properties of objects are necessary. For example, I'm assuming that while you're listening to me, your heart is beating. Otherwise, you're going to have big problems. So if your heart is beating, it couldn't be doing something else. That's just by its nature. That's what it do. What it does. It could, you couldn't have a heart that say just decided, oh, I don't. I'm too tired. I'm gonna take a little rest. The properties of the object are necessary. Now, remember all these things that the causal properties in object are part of its nature. So. And that, except for human choice, all the properties and objects are necessary, those are, in her view, part of a law of identity. A is A. So we have A is A, and in her view, if you say that, then you're committed to these other things. Causal properties of an object are part of its identity, and all properties and objects are necessary, leaving aside choices. Now, another consequence in her view of the law of identity is that nothing comes into existence without a cause. Supposing while I'm talking, a rabbit suddenly appeared next to me. Someone said, well, how did it get there? And I said, there wasn't any cause for it, just popped into existence. It just wasn't there one moment, and then suddenly here it is. She thinks that's not possible. Nothing comes into existence without a cause. So see, as you see, law of identity for her ASA isn't just a bare formula. ASA doesn't sound like very much. It's not something you want to deny, but you might think, well, it doesn't really commit you to much. It just says A is A, but in her view, it does. It has all these other consequences. Now, we can see, remember, when you have the law of identity, it says A is A, associated with the law of identity is law of contradiction or non-contradiction. Sometimes the same law is called law of contradiction, law of non-contradiction. That says something can't be A and not A at the same time. A thing is what it is, so it can't be that a thing is something else. So law of identity, law of non-contradiction are associated. So everything is what it is and not another thing. Everything is what it is identity, not another thing, is that non-contradiction. It just is what it is. And we can see if Atlas Shrugged in part 1, chapter 7, there's an episode, or an incident, where Francisco D'Anconia is talking to Dagny Taggart. Now, remember, Dagny Taggart is the heroine of the book, the main female character. She's one of the good people. She's the head of the, along with her no good brother, she's the head of a railroad line she's one of the productive people who are the heroes of the book. And Francisco is also one of these heroes. He had the kind of an aristocratic personality. He was a great, he achieved great things. However, Dagny thinks that Francisco is really in love with Dagny, but Dagny thinks he's just a playboy who squandered all his money and he's not doing any work and he's really worthless. And in fact, he isn't. He, as you'll see later, as you see with Galama novel, he's putting on an act because this way he's keeping track of what's going on in the world, and all the good people are going into Galt, the valley with Galt. So he's keeping track of what's going on. He's just pretending to be a playboy and a worthless person. So Dagny's puzzled because she has some evidence Francisco's a very good person, but at the same time he's acting, she thinks he's a playboy and does no useful work. So Francisco says to Dagny, his quotation, he says, contradictions cannot exist. Whenever you think that you're facing a contradiction, check your premises. You'll find that one of them is wrong. So he's saying to her, well, I can't be both a good person, some kind of useless bum, so if you think about things, you'll find out which of these contradictions, which side of contradiction is true. Of course, the side that's true is that he is a good person. But here you see in the novel how this fundamental principle law of identity and the associated law of non-contradiction applying practice. He's saying when you've got an apparent contradiction, appearances are deceiving because there can't be contradictions in reality. Now, here we get, we want to now turn to a topic we talked about, epistemology and metaphysics. Now we come to something that's really at the intersection of metaphysics and epistemology, which is free will. Remember I said, according to Rand, every property of an object is necessary except human free choices. She thinks that our choices aren't the inevitable results of previous conditions. So if you take my example, say each of you decided to attend my lecture. So your choice isn't to be accounted, according to her, by saying there were events in your past that made it necessary that you choose in that way, or that determined you to choose that way. You have the alternative of not coming to my lecture. You could have done something else, but you chose this way. So how do we know this? That's what she said, but how do we know we have free will? Well, she says, and I think this is a valid way of proceeding, she said, well, we just get this in experience. You know that you're making choices because you do make choices. You do have alternatives. You don't experience your actions as if things just are happening to you. It isn't, say, that you're experiencing, say, when it comes to close to 5:15, it isn't that you find your body's just moving automatically over to your computer screen and turning on my lecture. You're choosing to do that, and you're aware you could have chosen something else. So we're aware we have free choice. Now, she has a supplementary argument. She says if you deny free will, suppose somebody said, well, I don't think people have free will. There are people who hold that view. She says, well, that results in a contradiction, because then, suppose I say, I deny that I have free will. So if I'm right, my saying I deny that I have free will was determined. There was something causing me to say that. Because why is that? Well, because I'm denying that I have free will. I'm saying my choice is determined, so my choice to say I deny I have free will was also determined. And then she concludes, well, if that's the case, we couldn't have reason to think our denial of determinism is true. Now, that's, I will say, you know, so far I've just been giving what her theory is on these various philosophical problems without giving any criticism. We'll be getting to some analysis and criticism a little later. But here I should flag for you, this is a very controversial step. It's not clear that she's right, but supposing I deny we have free will, and my saying that is determined, why does it follow that I couldn't have reason to think that what I say is true? Maybe that's something you could raise in the discussion. Now, I see a comment here from Malcolm. It seems one could argue your point is circular. Yes, I think if you mean that she's assuming that we would have to have free will in order to be governed by reason, I think that's a good way of expressing the criticism. It isn't clear that we'd have to say that, although some people do find it clear. But I'm just wondering, just kind of flagging this, is it so evident that if we're determined, then we couldn't have reason to make any assertions? But supposing she's right, we do have free will. Well, what does our choice involve? What kind of things are we choosing? Now, she says, well, the fundamental choice is we have a choice either to think or not to think. And she calls this fundamental choice the choice to focus. We can say we're going to kind of apply our mind or not. Just kind of, we could just, if we don't, we'll just kind of be drifting, taking everything in passively. So she says we have a choice either to think, to focus, or not. That's the fundamental choice that we have. That's the fundamental expression of our free will. Now, in her opinion, a view that's promoted statism, or statism, opposition to the free market, is the view that most people do not choose to focus or think. So the view here that she's criticizing is that most people are irrational. They're not really capable of thinking. They've chosen not to think. So how would this promote statism? Suppose you think, well, people are just a bunch of dumbbells who are just reacting passively to things, who aren't really capable of focusing. Then, well, suppose you hold that, she thinks, then you may believe that people have to be controlled because these people are really not thinking. They can't decide things for themselves. And one expression of this in Atlas Shrugged is there's a scientist called Dr. Stadler, He was a, like, I'm a brilliant scientist. He was actually the teacher of John Galt and other people, good people in the novel. And he sold out his career as a scientist to work for the State Science Institute. The State Science Institute tries to keep all inventions, including Reardon's steel, which is the new kind of steel invented by Hank Reardon that's better, lighter, and stronger than existing steel. So they want to keep all the inventions under the control of the state. So the question is, how could Dr. Stadler, who's a brilliant scientist, work for this group that's trying to control science? And the reason he does that is that he thinks that people really don't choose to think, so they have to be controlled. And the expression, this is the quotation that he says this, and he says this several times in the novel, he says, but what can you do when you have to deal with people? So he said, well, when you're dealing with people, you're really dealing with this kind of, these kind of irrational beings that you have to control. Now, I've given you, or at least I'm trying to give you some account of what Rand says about metaphysics and theory. Now, I now want to go on. This is the part that gets me into trouble with objectivist sympathizers or objectivists. As you see, I'm not hostile to objectivism, but I do think that it can be, their points, the views can be criticized, and this is what gets me into trouble. So, and I should stop, put on my crash helmet, but I don't really have time to do that, so just have to hope for the best. Now, I want to deal first with the primacy of existence. Now, it seems to me the objectivist position that an external world exists seems right. We know that there's an external world. There are various philosophers who think we don't know this, who have skeptical arguments to say all we can be sure about is our own ideas. We can't really know that an external world exists, supposing, say, there were scientists who had just gotten our brains and put our brains in vats and were stimulating us in various ways. We have electrodes attached to our brain, and they can push buttons and we could get all sorts of experiences. We think there's an external world, but we have all the wrong, there wouldn't be the objects that we think we're seeing. Of course, in that scenario, there would be an external world. Maybe the scientists were doing all these things, right? We just have all the wrong views about what was in the external world. And I think it seems to me plausible to say, well, we just know there's an external world. And we can call this, some philosophers do, a Moorean fact, named after the great British philosopher G. Moore, George Edward Moore, who lived throughout the late 19th, early 20th century, one of the great British philosophers. And what he said is, well, we suppose you have one of these skeptical arguments, like how we know we're not brain and all that. So he said, well, our certainty that the world exists outweighs any skeptical arguments to the contrary. So he said, supposing someone comes up with this seemingly plausible argument, well, if we were brains in a vat, we just think the external world exists even though it doesn't. So anything we think is a proof the external world exists, anything we say, well, we're pointing to such and such a thing, so doesn't that show the external world exists? Like I say, it's more good. I'm lifting up one of my hands, lifting up another hand. So I have a proof there are two objects or two hands. So somebody says, well, but couldn't this scientist just may think where I'm seeing two hands, even though there aren't, more would say, well, there must be something wrong with this argument, even though we don't see what's wrong with the skeptical argument, because we just know the world is out there, and that's our certainty there is outweighs whatever strength we find in the skeptical argument. So I do think there's basically said for what Rand holds on the primacy of existence. But the problem, as I see it, with the objectivist view of primacy is they read too much into this point that we know the external world exists. In particular, it doesn't follow from the fact that the world exists that we directly grasp it with the senses. Remember, her view is the senses perceive similarities and differences in objects and we abstract out from that to get concepts. So, I mean, from the fact that the external world exists, it doesn't follow that we directly perceive the external world. There are other philosophical theories say that what we perceive are just our own ideas or sense data. Now, I'm not advocating such a theory. In fact, I think it is plausible we do directly perceive the external world, but all I'm saying is this doesn't immediately follow a theory of direct realism that we directly perceive the external world doesn't follow just from accepting that the external world exists. And so I think the objection is you're jumping too fast to direct realism, the view that we directly perceive the external world from just thinking that somehow follows from the primacy of existence. And one thing I should point out, when objectivists say we directly perceive physical objects, they don't mean by that perception, or when we're perceiving objects, is a kind of a transparent process, something like our senses really don't do anything, it's just we just look out at the world and the world appears to us as it exactly is. That isn't what they mean by direct perception. They just mean when, say, I'm looking at a computer screen, there isn't anything between my mind and the computer screen that I'm really seeing, like a picture in my mind's eye that I'm looking at. I'm looking directly at the screen. But that doesn't imply that the whole activity of perception isn't doing anything. It is that the way I'm perceiving doesn't affect what I'm perceiving. And if you want to go into the details of the Rand's view of perception, a very good book by David Kelly, I put some of his stuff on the reading list, he has a very good book called The Evidence of the Senses, where it goes into the objectivist view of perception. Now, again, I want to say that the Rand's objectivists are starting off with a good point, but here's a way, again, that they go too far with it. I think this tends to be characteristic of their methods of epistemology. Now, what they correctly point out is the external world confronts us, and we can't change the world just by changing our thought. Supposing you had enough of my lecture and just want me to go away, well, you could get me to go away just by thinking, let's get rid of David, let's bring Stefan Molyneux in here instead to finish out the lecture. You can't do that. You'd have to, if you don't want me, you have to turn me off. We can't change the world just by changing our thoughts. So far, I think the objections were perfectly correct. But nothing follows from this about the nature of the external world, what it consists of. The external world could be composed entirely of mental objects and partly mental objects. So what the objectivist thing is, well, if we can't change the world, we can't just change the world by thinking about it, then the world is composed of matter, of physical material. But an idealist could say, well, it could be composed, the physical objects could consist entirely of ideas, but we can't change them because they're not our ideas. Remember, Bishop Berkeley held the view that what we're really seeing, when we see objects, are really ideas, that God's ideas. So the physical world really consists of God's ideas, and we're looking at that. Now that's kind of an unusual metaphysical theory, and I'm not advocating that, but all I'm saying here is that it doesn't follow that theory's false just by recognizing we can't change the world just by changing our thoughts about it. So I think the objectivists have jumped too quickly from this notion that the world is out there and confronting us to saying, well, we know what the world is made of. And further, the fact that the world is just out there doesn't rule out creation of the world by God. The objectivists think it does because they say, well, if there were a God who created the physical world, then it would just be some sort of idea in his mind that could be changed just by thinking about it. But it wouldn't follow that if God created the world, that we wouldn't be confronting the world as external to us. It's just a jump. It's as if they think, well, if the world is created, it must be kind of this kind of insubstantial thing, just like a passing thought or something like that. But that wouldn't follow at all. At least I'm not seeing why it would. Maybe if you think so, you can raise this in the discussion. Now, the objectivists would respond, and I know they would respond this way because this is the way they have responded, not specifically to me, but to people who raise criticisms like the ones I've given. They say, the criticisms I've just given rest on a misunderstanding. They would say, what I've been saying so far is it doesn't follow, if you say, except the primacy of existence, that the world is out there. We don't just make up the world by thinking about it. The world, physical world is out there. So I said, well, it doesn't follow from that the world is composed of non-mental matter, and it doesn't follow the world hasn't been created by God. So they would say the error I'm making is that I'm taking their view to be that these contentions, namely the world is composed of matter, not ideas, that the world hasn't been created by God. And I'm taking these contentions as if they were logical deductions from an axiom called the primacy of existence. So what I've been doing is saying, look, here we have primacy of existence, and these things don't follow from it. So they would say, no, that's not what we're saying. What they contend is that these points, namely the world consists of matter and it's not, the world hasn't been created by God, those are things that are out there in the world, and I just, the primacy of existence is a generalization from these things, these truths that are out there, these facts about the world that are out there. So the primacy of existence is kind of a way of summing up these various other facts. So it isn't as if I'm saying, well, here's something, primacy of existence, and you logically deduce all these other things. You go the other way. You have these various details, and primacy of existence is kind of a abstraction from them. And when you think about how you get the abstraction, you get be able to come up with these details. But then if they say that, the question is, do we in fact know these claimed facts that the world hasn't been created by God or composed of non-mental matter? I see there's a question of, would you say this is why objectivism in of itself resembles a religion? Well, I'm not clear why that would follow, it would resemble a religion. I mean, I think all it would follow is it has certain views that you might want to claim we're not that sure or well-founded. We might want to know, are they as well-founded as they think they are? But I don't think that in itself would establish a resemblance to a religion. Maybe, again, this is something we maybe could discuss later. I'm not really seeing how that inference goes. Now, related to this, kind of sort of the most basic criticism I think one could make, objectivist metaphysics, is they draw too much from this law of identity. The logical law of identity simply says that A is A. It doesn't follow from that everything has a fixed nature in the sense of a persisting identity in time. That would be a separate contention. I suppose we had a world where everything kept changing randomly. So that's to say there couldn't be such a world. Now if you say, well, if you talk about change, does that imply that something remains the same? Suppose you say something is changing, there has to be something that persists through the change, or otherwise you wouldn't say it's a change of that thing. Well, if you say that, well, let's change the example. Let's imagine they're just momentary existences, things that just exist for a moment. They're constantly randomly replaced by other things. We just kind of imagine kind of a world that just consists of kind of flickerings of light from one microsecond to another. Everything just kept constantly shifting. That's entirely consistent with the logical law of identity. The logical law of identity doesn't say that there couldn't be such a world. I think I'll save the comments for the question here. I just see one interesting point from David Kramer, says denying free will is an example of free will, therefore self-contradictory. Well, I don't really see that, because someone who was a determinist could say when he's denying free will, it isn't an example of free will. He could say, no, he's determined to deny that, so it isn't apparent why it would be self-contradictory, at least. But as you said, maybe there's a lot more to that argument, but again, this is something we're going to talk about later. Now, again, the objectivists say that nothing can come into existence without a cause, but suppose, remember my example, where I say the rabbit wasn't here, here's the rabbit. So I say, well, it didn't have a cause, it just materialized. What would be impossible about that? What's the contradiction? Or it would be much better, it would be much better lecture if I could actually come up with a rabbit, but I don't have one. So what I think the objectivist would answer here, and also to my previous point, they'd say, well, supposing something just came into existence, or supposing things just occurred randomly, there was no constant properties of causation, then they'd say there'd be no reason these events would take place. Something is random, it would just There'd be no reason for it. So isn't that, shouldn't we reject this hypothesis? Because there's no reason, I'm supposing, to say, well, just things happen randomly. I'd be saying, it's just arbitrary, the world be arbitrary. So here, if you give that as a reason to reject this hypothesis that things just happen randomly or things are just coming to existence, we'd be affirming what Leibniz called the principle of sufficient reason, which is if whatever happens or whatever exists has a reason for its existence. So here there'd be things that happen, if things just come into existence without a cause, there'd be no reason for it. So that would violate the principle of sufficient reason. But the difficulty here is, whether you accept principle of sufficient reason or not, that's a different principle from law of identity. And it isn't evident that principle of sufficient reason follows from law of identity. Leibniz didn't think that it did, for example. He accepted both. He didn't think he could derive principle of sufficient reason from law of identity. So the basic point I'd like you to remember here is what the objectivists seem to be doing in some of their contention is they're thinking that the law of identity implies that there's a reason or cause for whatever happens, and I'm not seeing why one would have to say that. Now, also, suppose though we agree with the objectivists that all entities have a fixed nature. I said that doesn't follow from the law of identity. But suppose we think, I think they have a good case, so everything has a fixed nature. Now, does it follow from that that God doesn't exist? Now, Leonard Peikoff says, well, it does follow, say everything has a fixed nature, it follows that God doesn't exist because God is an infinite being, and an infinite being has no fixed nature. So, therefore, God can't exist because every being that exists has a fixed nature. For the purpose of the argument, we're accepting this premise that all entities have a fixed nature. But the problem with this argument is, why should we say that God doesn't have a fixed nature? A fixed nature doesn't have to be one that's limited or power in power and knowledge. We could say God's nature is he can do whatever he wants to do, or he knows everything there is to know. Whether you find that a plausible view or not, it doesn't seem to be denying that God has a fixed nature. So I'm not giving this as an argument for God's existence. I'm just saying this is the case where the objectivists are, again, rather too fast to come up with metaphysical principles and implications of them. Now, another thing the objectivists hold, as I mentioned, is that they think, remember, aside from human choices, everything in the world is necessary, couldn't have been otherwise. So the actual world is the only possible world. That's just another way of saying things couldn't have been otherwise. Now, this strikes me as implausible. Do we really want to say it's logically required that what in fact exists must exist? For example, suppose we say, had things been different, the Earth might not have existed. It seems to make sense, doesn't it? Why would we want to say that's impossible? It isn't clear why we should say that. Now, I think most people would say, well, you know, things could have been different. So it seems that the objectivist views on necessity are at odds with the views on necessity that most people have. That doesn't show the objectivists are wrong, but if our views, if the we think they're wrong, then I think the objective is to show why we should reject our ordinary views. If we think it makes sense to say the rule could have been otherwise, why should we change that? It isn't a good reason to change that. It's a consequence of the law of identity that everything is necessary. That's what I've been trying to argue for so far. So the question would come up, well, if the objectivist views on necessity are seen at odds with the ones most people hold, why do they adopt them? And I would suggest the key is Rand's theory of concept. And according to her, we get concepts by abstraction from the external world. So we don't really have a concept of a possible world different from the natural world, because if we're looking at the physical world, we would just get what's there in the world. We wouldn't be able to get a concept of some other world that's different from the actual world. How could our senses put us in touch with anything other than the actual world? So I think the objectivists would say, well, we couldn't, these concepts of other possible worlds are illegitimate because they're not derived from the actual world. So that's why they think the actual world is the only possible one, because that's the only world we could have concepts of. And you can see how we can have free will, because we can get the concept of free will from our actual choices. So then this tells us we do have free will. But then if that's how they get their view, we have a new problem, which is, why should we accept Rand's view of concepts? Now, if you look at an Introduction to Objectivist Epistemology and other objectivist works on theory of knowledge, they don't really give arguments for the theory of concepts. They just explain the theory in quite substantial detail, and they answer criticism that people have. They don't really give arguments that we get all our concepts through abstraction from the external world. Well, somebody said, as some philosophers do, Descartes said this, that philosophers think we have innate ideas that we don't get by each other. What exactly is the argument that there aren't such ideas? It isn't clear that the objectivists give us any such argument. And further, there appears to be a big problem with Rand's theory of concept. Remember, the way the theory goes, this is what we talked about earlier, is that we first grasp similarities and differences among entities. I see all sorts of different red objects, and they're different shades of red. We can measure these, say, imagine these shades of red being measured on a scale. Then we could just drop the differences in measurement, and we have the relevant concept, in this case, the color red. So it seems, though, if you look at it that way, Rand seems to be giving us a way to get from a more complicated concept, namely red with certain measurements, to a simpler concept, the color red. And how do we get this more complicated concept, namely red with the measurements, not we get concept through measurement omission, but how do we get the concept through with the measurements not omitted? Now the objection, the answer would be, this objection rests on a mistake, because it isn't, in their view, that we need concepts to grasp similarities and differences. They say we grasp with similarities and differences through the senses. So it's not that we start off with more complicated concepts and simplify them. It's that we grasp the similarities and differences in a non-conceptual way through sense perception. So as Kelly stresses, we have to grasp, see the similarities and contrast the differences. But then, if we say that, so it still rather mysterious how we got a concept out of it. We have the senses of grasping these similarities and differences. And then I said, well, if we then omit the measurements, but it isn't clear exactly how we're supposed to be doing that. Now, some objectivists say, well, if we don't adopt this theory of concepts, that we get concepts through abstraction from what senses perceive, then we have no guarantee that our concepts agree with reality. Because suppose we don't get concepts from abstraction from the senses, how do we know that they're true? Maybe we just say we have innate ideas, maybe nothing in reality out there corresponds to the innate ideas. So if you deny we get concepts through abstraction from the senses, then doesn't this open the door to skepticism about whether we know things? But the problem with this, I'm going to suggest, and I think I'll conclude with this, it isn't concepts that are true. Say I have a concept red, that isn't either true or false. It's propositions, it's statements about that say something is the case or not the case. Like, well, I say, my head is on my shoulders. That would be either a true or false statement. So I could say that's true. So as long as we can find out if a proposition is true, that's all we need. And we don't need to ground concepts in percepts to guarantee truth. Or at least it's not clear to me why we need to do this. So I'm now going to end the lecture. As I said, this is kind of a tough lecture dealing with these very difficult subjects. I hope I haven't complicated them more than necessary. But I now want to go, I'm going to go to the Q&A box, so you can either type in your questions, comments over there. I just see one from Dave. Do you have an example in any way? Well, I'm not advocating such a theory, but an example, some people say, well, we get the idea would be the idea of a cause. We wouldn't have the notion of cause just from the external world. This is innate. We wouldn't have, say, the notion of substance. Those are examples. Defending that theory, I'm just saying, it's not clear to me that the objectivists have arguments against it. So let me just open the Q&A box here, and then we'll go to the open the chat one too. Malcolm asked a very interesting question. How would Ayn Rand reconcile the law of identity with what occurs in subatomic physics? And here I think you're probably referring to certain things like in quantum mechanics, there's supposed to be various events that happen without a cause. Well, what the objectivists do is they say the parts of subatomic physics that go against objectivist philosophy are just wrong. They're based on mistaken philosophical ideas. So the objectivists say physicists such as Heisenberg and others who were developing quantum mechanics had all sorts of wrong ideas about philosophy, and physics needs to be reconstructed in a way so it doesn't have these wrong ideas. There are various objectivist physicists who try to do that. I think David Harriman is one who's written on those things to say people have a wrong, physicists have a wrong view of philosophy. So they're quite willing to say physicists are wrong about physics if it goes against their view of philosophy. Now, Malcolm also said, would Ayn Rand deny existence of instinct, or would she would say that instinct is simply making connections to the previous experience? She doesn't think we have kind of innate tendencies to act in a way. We would build them up from experience. We could tend to act very rapidly or in a suddenly automatic manner based on experiences we have. But I think in their view, we human beings don't have instincts. She contrasts human beings with animals who do operate on instincts. She thinks human beings don't. Here's one. Here's one from David. What Rand have argued that if it is the nature of A to change and A does indeed change, then A still equals A after A changes. Yes, because that's a very good question. It would be part of the nature of A that it changed in just that way. And the point, and this is one thing that Aristotle says in his, when he's analyzing change. If suppose A changes in certain ways and you didn't say it was A anymore, then it wouldn't be A that it would be changed. It would have just changed. It would have been replaced by something else. So for in order for change to take place, there has to be something that remains the same, because otherwise it's not that thing that's changing. For example, supposing I were now to change into Stefan Molyneux, would have to be something in me that is remaining constant, that changing into an appearance of him. Otherwise, I would have simply been replaced by him. It wouldn't be changed. Now, Cray says, I think Aristotle and Rand would also suggest the thing is what it is at the time. Yes, that's right. But you're right, there's identity at a particular time. There's also identity through time. But both of them would reject the view that all there is to identity is just identity at certain point instances. They would say, no, there's persistent substances that go on. So there's both identity at a time and over time. Yes, and so there's a good comment about the type of t-shirt he would wear. Never mind him. I hope nobody in this class is in his, also a follower of his and posting what I say on his site. I had no idea he had so many fans, I must say. Oh, now here's one. Leslie, what the objective is say, if constantly not grounded in principle, and propositions with such concepts would not be true. Yes, that's a very good question. Like they would say that, they'd say, if you had a proposition with some alleged concept that wasn't properly grounded, then the proposition would contain a meaningless term, so it wouldn't be really saying anything. They think if it can't be shown how a concept is ultimately abstract from the senses, ultimately, because remember, you can get concepts by abstractions from other concepts, but you have to be able to get down to the senses. You can't just have concepts to abstract from concepts, abstract from further concepts without getting down to the senses. But if you can't do that, you've got a proposition with a meaningless term. Oh, now, let me see something here. I see 2 points here. What is it? Oh, I see quite a few points here. Okay, now here's one from Tim. I think the reason why some see objectivism in religion may be because of logical flaws and concepts demand one have faith in the objection's explanation, i.e. the action criticism rather than reliance on theory in their explanatory works. But I think, you know, that tends to vary with the different objectives. Some I think don't respond too well to objections, where there are others who try to answer the objections. You know, they're sort of different kinds of objectives. I think you're right, there is a tendency among some of them to not be closed to criticism. They just, one thing that happens is they just tend not to see the force of certain criticisms that non-objectivist philosophers think are pretty conclusive, so somewhat of an impasse, that say a lot of non-objectivist philosophers will say, look, you're reading too much into the law of identity. They don't see it that way at all. So that'd be an example of what happens in disputes sometimes. Now, Malmsteen, previously I said, what would you say, why objectivism in some sense is rigid? What I meant by that is, if one disagrees with concept of objectivism, that person not living reality. As such, a person who's not living reality would be suspect and perhaps subject to ostracism, is that person's logic actions would always be suspect. Well, I think they would think that people who don't have properly formed concepts are making mistakes, but you wouldn't call they'd have to be ostracized. I mean, I guess that would depend on the particular circumstance of how the objectors were related to those persons. I think if someone was in the objectivist group and then just started rejecting objectivism, that would tend to lead to trouble for that person, but not always. It would, you know, just depend on circumstances. Now, Patricio says, I read that Ayn Rand promised himself never to have to explain the books of the beast, or ultimately spent many years doing so. You think she's more understood today than, say, 30 or 40 years ago? Well, I think there are more people who are studying her thought than before, so I think people aren't progressing in understanding her, and I think people are seeing the alternatives better. Now, David said, Kelly seems a bit contradictory when discussing emotion. He said there's a subconscious integration of information. The subconscious or unconscious mind seems like a contradiction from the objectivist position. Well, I think he's not thinking that subconscious integration is really done conceptually, though. This is really just the senses are taking all this in. And so he thinks that I'm not clear. Well, let me rephrase my answer if I can give him such a good answer. It's not clear, there couldn't be subconscious rational thought on the objectivist view, but it's not clear why there couldn't be subconscious integration of information. That would be something like a sensory process. It wouldn't have to be strictly sensory. It could have some mental elements to it. But I don't think that would directly contradict anything they're saying. Now here's one from Wes. If Rand is wrong about objectivism, does that mean she's also wrong about man's rights, the nature of government, and capitalism? No, now I don't think it would be, because now she would be wrong if you accepted her view that views about ethics and political philosophy follow from metaphysics and epistemology. And if you get the wrong metaphysics and epistemology, you'll get the wrong views about ethics and government and capitalism. But if you think she's wrong about that too, she could be right about these other things. Then further, it could be the case that she's right about the metaphysics and epistemology, but the argument she gives for her conclusions are wrong. So perhaps some problem, it could be she's right about them. I think there are ways one could get around that objection. Now here's one Mari said, "Whether that objection is valid and his thought is true and is valid as just through his real world activities bringing results and desires into existence." No, see, that would be pragmatism. That's say the truth is what you produce, but certainly there are some things you bring into existence, but in the random, you don't just produce the world. It's there that your world is out there confronting you. You make something, but you don't construct the entire world. So you could show, say, if you had ideas about building things and then you built them successfully according to your specification, like say if you take an Atlas Shrug, you see Hank Reardon thinks there's some, has some ideas about how to produce steel better, and then he succeeds in producing the steel, so that validates his ideas, but that wouldn't be the basic to how we know our thoughts are true. That would be just with certainly can show that certain of our ideas are successful, or we can validate certain scientific hypotheses by testing them. But the fundamental point is the world confronts us. We're not constructing it with our mind. We're just there, and it's our job to find out what it's like. Okay, well, we still have a few more minutes to go. Now, do people tend to find the objectionist views plausible or not plausible? Or maybe there's some more comments here. Here's one I missed. I missed a couple here. Now one is David Kramer. What was Murray Rothbard's view of rank? Well, he went through various stages. First, his first encounter with her, he first kind of rejected her. He thought she was somewhat totalitarian in her mentality. But then when Atlas Shrugged came out, he was very enthusiastic about that book. He thought it was a great book. Sent her a fan letter. Then they got together, his group, the Circle Bastiat, got together with her group called The Collective, and they met, but there were personal problems that developed. So he thought there was a good deal in her metaphysics and theory and knowledge, but he thought she had the wrong views about government. She was, I believe, in a minimal state. Rothbard was an anarchist, and they didn't get along personally. And Rothbard wasn't, although he believes in Aristotelian ethics, he wasn't an ethical egoist in the way that she is in her philosophy. Patricia said, "Do you think that Ayn Rand's ideas are valid across nationalities and geography? Did she have an opinion about applicability of ideas in other parts?" Well, yes, well, she certainly thought that ideas don't vary according to your nationality. Where you are, something is true. If A is A, that's true not just in America, but it's true in Brazil, in Africa, all over the world. And I think this is a very plausible view she has. So if she's right for everybody, not though if she's wrong, she's also wrong. I mean, it could be the case that there could be a true theory that said that under such and such conditions in certain countries, this applies in other countries, something else would apply. But the idea itself wouldn't vary with the nationality. That would be kind of a relativistic principle. It would be something like what Mises in Human Action calls polylogism, so view that people of different nationalities or classes have different ways of thinking. I think that position doesn't have much to be said for it, at least. Polylogism doesn't have much to be said for it, at least not in the United States. Another joke. Who's last? Okay. Now here's what I'm... Malcolm wants to know about the differences to the environment of a community where you live based on objective philosophy versus an Austrian philosophy. Well, remember, the Austrian economics is just a scientific theory about how the economy works. So it doesn't imply any conclusions about what kind of community you'd have. Now, given certain preferences that people actually do have, it's very plausible that if you accepted Austrian economics, you would also accept a free market, and that would be perfectly consistent with objectivist philosophy. But you should just be clear that Austrian views on economics don't directly imply political conclusions. Now wait, here's one, Patricia, oh, thank you. Oh, you're very welcome. Everett says, infinite God, I have a fixed nature. One might think that having all the omni attributes, omniscient, omnipresent, only time, etc., that God would have the most fixed nature because God would have it all, no gaps in any attributes, meaning the most complete and thus fixed nature. Now, that's an interesting argument. Well, I think, though, if you say you took a more limited being, like I say, you had somebody say a human being has just very limited knowledge and doesn't have all these attributes, that wouldn't suggest that, it wouldn't follow from that that more limited being had gaps in his attributes. I'm not clear what that means. It would just be his attributes would be limited in various ways, but it wouldn't be kind of, there are kind of holes in his attributes that didn't happen, so they kind of, you think of the being is kind of there with certain properties that they're just kind of blanks in them that aren't filled up. I don't think that would follow from the being being limited, but it's an interesting point you raised. Thanks for the reading. It's very helpful. I got some nice students in this class, unlikely. The nice students in the other class, too, not including the infiltrator. Wesley, am I a nice student? Yeah, yes, I mean, as long as you're not posting to the Molyneux site. I'd hardly heard of him before I did the book review. It was very strange. Washington, I read a bit of your article today on Mises.org. Thank you. That's additional evidence. You're nice. Oh, now one thing I should mention. I forgot about this. Next week, we're going to have a break because I'm going to be away at Mises U next week. So the next lecture will not be next Tuesday, but the week after that. I should have mentioned that before. Sorry about that. At least I think that's the case. I better check that with Danny. Let me see. Could we all ring and get a tattoo? What would Stefan Molyneux do? Cam said I'll email it out. Well, I'm going to have to think I'll defer that suggestion. Yeah, I'd like to see you lose thirsty for morning. Kane would be a good one. We could bring in. Okay, now here's one. Somebody says, Tim says, I was a long-time mom. He's great on parenting. You point out serious and not a new evidence law. Oh, well, thank you. I'm not familiar with his views on philosophical parenting. You know, I wasn't, and I say, no, seriously, I wasn't intending to condemn everything he does. I was just commenting a particular book review. I never would have done that had I known all the trouble I would have caused. Okay, well, I guess we're about out of time now, so thanks very much. So I'll be seeing you all in 2 weeks from today, unless it turns out I'm supposed to give a lecture from Auburn, but I don't think so. So thanks. Oh, now here's a question from Wesley. I'm also reading through the table of conceit right now. Do you think Hayek's on social science to match that of the Austrian scholars? Well, I think Hayek was a little more sympathetic to social Darwinism than Mises, but I don't think he could be. He was interested in competition among societies, but he never took the view that the poor should just be kind of left aside because they're obstacles on the way to human evolution. He just thought that there was competition among societies and somewhat of a Darwinian process, but he wasn't the social Darwinist in the way that my article was talking about. Okay, thanks everybody. Well, I tend to be more, agree more with Mises actually, but Hayek, you know, was my teacher. He had a lot of good points too. Okay, thank you. Bye everybody. See you next time. Oops, what is it?